Chapter 29. Tom looks at the symbol that's been spray-painted across his sliding glass door that leads into the backyard and sighs. "Now this is just rude," he complains. "They couldn't put it on the front door so I could paint over it again? This is going to be a bitch to remove. I'm going to have to call somebody."
"That's your biggest complaint?"
Peter asks, clearly amused. "They're clearly intending to come kill us tonight, and your concern is your home aesthetic?" "I don't intend to die, so yeah, a little common courtesy would be nice," Tom says, and Peter just laughs. "Do we have any sort of plan? We should send the kids to stay somewhere safe." Peter shakes his head. "I don't know that splitting up is a good idea. After all, there are 5 alphas. They could easily go get the kids while we were here. There's safety and strength in numbers."
"Last time I thought that, Gerard Argent surrounded us all with mountain ash and guns and burned my house to the ground."
"Fair point," Peter says. "But I don't know where we would send them that any of us would consider safe. Argent's, maybe, but then we don't have the option of calling him to help out."
Tom sighs. "I'm not sure what Chris could do."
"Set up a sniper rifle, preferably."
"I'm not sure that would be the best idea."
"What do you think is going to happen when I tell Deucalion to fuck off for what will be the last time?" Peter asks, arching an eyebrow. "Do you think he's just going to say, 'Oh, sorry to have disturbed you,' and leave? I very much doubt that. Therefore, we need to be prepared to strike first."
"But that's the whole problem," Tom says. "According to Ethan, Deucalion uses the first strike as an excuse to kill the entire pack. We don't know what will happen if we just tell Deucalion to leave, because nobody has ever done it. We should..." Peter rolls his eyes so hard that his whole head moves.
"The twin says nobody has ever done it, and for some reason you believed him. Are you kidding? Deucalion's not going to let somebody say no. He'll murder every last one of us, and I, for one, intend to make sure that doesn't happen, even if it means I have to murder him first. And I'm so very sorry if his lawfulness doesn't agree."
"Don't be a prick," Tom says.
"I'll be a prick when it's called for," Peter says. "You're being ridiculous. Deucalion doesn't need more than one move to kill us. Yet you want me to stand back and give Deucalion the opportunity to make that move so you can feel it's justified when we kill him?"
"No," Tom says. "What I want is to have a rational discussion about this, like adults, without you diving headfirst back into mocking me for my moral compass."
"I'm not mocking you." "Yes, you are." Tom struggles with his temper. "Call me his lawfulness again and I'll clean your clock." Peter's mouth thins. "All right, that was uncalled for. But my point stands. I don't intend to let Deucalion make the first move, and I don't care whether you like that or not."
"Well, if you'd allowed me to actually make my point, instead of assuming you knew what I was going to say, my point was going to be that it's stupid to make that move exactly when he expects it. When he shows up to issue his ultimatum, he's going to be expecting us to attack. We need to handle tonight another way and make our move at a different time."
Peter is blinking at him, and he clears his throat and says, "Yes. That does make sense."
Tom folds his arms over his chest and says nothing.
"What did you have in mind?" Peter asks.
"Avoiding the entire meeting," Tom says. "We don't need to be here to receive his ultimatum. We already know what it's going to be, and you've already given him an answer. That will show Deucalion exactly what we think of him. Then we need to figure out where they are. The twins attending high school is Deucalion's way of keeping an eye on the betas. I say we turn it back on him. I'm sure Chris has any number of tracking devices. We can have one of the kids stick in their car or backpack or whatever. Then we make a plan of attack for when they won't expect it."
Peter nods slowly. "God, that's hot."
"You know, you can't just sidetrack me with sex every time I'm mad at you," Tom tells him.
"Don't be mad. I said I was sorry."
"No, actually, you didn't," Tom says.
"Well, I am."
"Then say so, and moreover, cut this shit out. I mean it."
"I am sorry," Peter says, "and you're brilliant, and I don't deserve you."
"Okay," Tom says, and is vaguely thinking about whether or not they have time for a quickie when his radio crackles.
Stilinski, he says.
Boss, it's me. Tara's voice is troubled. We found another body, and it's even weirder than usual.
Text me the GPS. I'm on my way, Tom says.
He looks at Peter and says, what do you think is safer, your apartment or Derek's loft?
Probably the loft. They almost definitely know where I live, but they probably haven't bothered to follow Derek around.
Okay, pick up the kids after school and I'll meet you there. Peter leans in for a quick kiss.
You're a terrible beta, you know that?
It's the alpha in me, Tom can't help but tease. Peter's eyes gleam.
Rain check, apparently.
Rain check, Tom agrees. The first thing that Tom notices is that the sacrifice, if that's what it is, wasn't done by the same method. No head injury, no throat wound, not even any ligature marks. Just straight-up asphyxiation. This actually seems less weird than the others, he remarks to Tara.
Except for the part where she was abducted from her car literally while she was driving in it? Tara asks, and Tom blinks at her.
This is a doctor, right? She was on her way into the hospital last night. Traffic cam footage shows her here. She sets down a photograph of the doctor in her car. But then not 3 minutes later, the car drifts into the parking lot at the hospital and hits another car. Like she just disintegrated.
Or like she jumped out, Tom says.
But there's no evidence she jumped out, Tara says. The body had no bruises, no abrasions, even at low speed. And get this. Her seatbelt was still buckled.
Jesus, Tom mutters, pinching the bridge of his nose.
Yeah, that's unlikely.
Plus there's another doctor missing, Tara says. He was on shift last night and just went up in smoke. Nobody saw him leave. None of the cameras picked up anything weird. He's just gone. That was about 4 hours before Dr. Hilliard's car crashed.
So he may still be alive somewhere, Tom says. Although he's not sure why the Darak would have changed methods, not just in the way they were killed, but in the timing.
Okay, I've got to make a few calls. Let me know if anything else comes in.
He goes down to the hospital to check the security footage himself, but it's just like Tara had said. 1 minute the ER physician was seeing patients, the next he excused himself to the restroom, and he never came back. There was no camera that took in the bathroom door, so the most likely explanation deducted from different. He asks Chris, since he doubts Peter will know. I know you said Healers was one of the sets of three, but why kill them in such a different way?
Something symbolic, probably, Chris says. But you think one of them could still be alive?
I think it's possible, Tom says. Hell, the third one isn't even missing yet. Or if they are, I don't know about it. These are people whose disappearances would be noticed right away.
Okay. I have kind of a theory. Can you make some time?
Yeah, sure, Tom says, and waits expectantly.
It's a visual thing. I've got maps.
Oh, okay. I'll be over in about 10 minutes.
He puts in his Bluetooth, which he hates, and checks in with Peter while he drives.
All quiet on the home front, Peter assures him. He's at Derek's, and they're talking about buying some snacks to keep the teenagers occupied if they're stuck at the loft all evening.
Chris greets him with a handshake and shows Tom into his office, where he's got a large map of Beacon Hills and the surrounding area tacked up on his wall.
Where was the latest body found? He asks, and hands Tom a pushpin.
He walks over and pushes it into the map, and Chris nods.
Okay, that's what I thought. Whoever the Darak is, they're leaving the bodies on the ley lines. They're probably making the sacrifices there as well.
Okay, Tom says. What the hell are ley lines, actually? Peter says they're like power lines.
That's as good a way to put it as any. It has to do with geomagnetic fields, the way they move and are affected by the atmosphere. Where they overlap most frequently, it creates pockets of power, and the lines between those pockets of power are the ley lines.
And the bodies being found?
In the pockets, yeah. But they have to be sacrificing the victims on the lines as well if they want the full effect.
Tom grimaces a little.
That's still a lot of searchable land.
Well, yes and no. It only takes a few seconds to dump a body. The sacrifice itself will take longer. They're not going to do it in the middle of the street.
I've narrowed down some possibilities. Okay, Tom's phone rings, and he resists the urge to say, what now? He glances down at the screen and sees a local number that's not saved into his phone. Hello?
Tom, it's Alan, Deaton's voice says. I hate to trouble you like this, but I'm afraid you're my only hope. I'm going to be taken. I need you to find me.
Tom wonders why he even got out of bed that morning. Taken? Taken where? By who? Listen, you cryptic. He realizes he's talking into dead air, curses, and shoves his phone back into his pocket. We have to get to Deaton's clinic. It occurs to him halfway there that Peter will probably be annoyed that he's charging into danger without him, but he doesn't want to wait, so he'll have to endure the lecture later. But there is no danger, or if there was, it's long gone. The clinic is empty and quiet. He supposes that he can't be positive Deaton was calling him from the clinic, but it's 1 p.m. on a weekday. It's where he should have been.
Do you think a veterinarian counts as a healer? He asks Chris.
A regular one? Maybe not. But Deaton? Tom grimaces. He knows that Deaton isn't the typical vet.
Guess we'd better get started searching those spots on the ley lines.
Chris nods. I'll drive. Derek glances over as he hears his uncle's phone buzz with an incoming text, and then hears his heartbeat pick up.
What is it? He asks,
his shoulders going tense despite himself.
Apparently Deaton's gone and gotten himself abducted by the Dara, Peter says, then shrugs.
Oh well, not my problem. And if Tom's busy all day hunting ley lines for him, he won't get into trouble with Deucalion.
Were we worried about that? Derek asks dryly.
With Tom, it's a real concern, yes. I can never tell when he's going to suddenly throw himself into the maw of danger because he feels like it's the right thing to do. Besides, this will give me a chance to do a few things without having to defend myself against his moralizing.
Derek gives him a sideways look.
You said Tom already agreed that we're going to kill Deucalion. What is he moralizing about?
Oh, you know, everything, Peter says, waving this aside.
Derek sighs. And what is it that you want to do?
Tom doesn't want to make a move tonight because it's what they're going to be expecting. And don't look at me like that. I'm not going to ask you to help me lie to Tom. I agree with him, but I doubt Deucalion is going to. The hope is that we can avoid the whole thing by just not being where they expect us to be. But we can't be sure they don't know about the loft, that they won't find us here.
Then why don't we go somewhere else? Derek asks. I mean, there are places that could be safer. Chris Argent's house, the police station surrounded by cops, the moon.
Unless you have Elon Musk on speed dial, I doubt the latter will work, Peter says.
He shakes his head a little and says,
there's nowhere in Beacon Hills that we'd truly be safe. We don't know exactly how much Deucalion and his pack have found out about us, or if they have other ways to track us. If there's even a small chance they can find us, I'd prefer it to be somewhere like here, and I'd prefer to be prepared for it.
Okay, Derek says, nodding. He agrees with Tom that it's better to avoid the confrontation if possible, but he can see where Peter's coming from, too. Even if he turns out to be incorrect, the impulse to guard, to protect, lingers in both of them. Neither of them had seen Kate Argent's attack coming. Neither of them would ever completely recover from the paranoia that left in them.
Then let's go pick up a few things at Home Depot and get to work.
Tom very quickly finds himself frustrated. Driving along the ley lines is impossible because of the way they cut through buildings and forest, so their journey is hit or miss at best. Sometimes they're on foot, and although he's certainly in better shape than he used to be, he keenly feels the press of time. Peter will be picking the kids up any minute. He wants to be back at the loft before the sun sets. His radio crackles, and he picks up with, "Hey, what have you got?"
"They found Dr. Hilliard's body," Tara says grimly. "Same manner of death as the other doctor."
Tom swears. "Forward me the coordinates, okay?" he says, figuring they can add it to Chris's map, and maybe it will magically shed some light on where Deaton's going to be.
Okay, and I've got the ME on the horn for you. He says he knows more about the COD.
Great, patch him through, Tom says. He puts it on speaker so Chris can hear, because at this point he figures what the hell, why not?
I've figured out how the asphyxiation happened, the medical examiner says. There's no ligature marks, which you knew, but there are very deep marks on the wrists. He must have been suspended.
Meaning? Tom says.
Hanging like that, you're fighting against gravity to breathe. You have to pull yourself up in order to take a breath. Eventually, the person loses the strength to do so and can't lift themselves up anymore. It's actually how crucifixion kills.
Tom files that under things he never particularly wanted or needed to know. Once the victim no longer has the strength to pull themselves up, how long before death?
Minutes, the ME responds.
Tom thanks him and hangs up, then looks at Chris and says, okay, so we can rule out a lot of the places on this map if it's somewhere they're going to leave a victim suspended for hours. I'm not a fan of pull-ups myself, but when it's that or death, I think it would take a while for it to happen.
Chris nods. But we've already checked most of the places like that.
Shit. Tom pushes both hands through his hair. I want to go back to the clinic. There might be a clue there that we've missed, and I think I'm going to have Tara call the next of kin at this point. I know Deaton has a sister. Maybe she can do the same sort of druid stuff and help us find him. They're halfway through searching the things in Deaton's clinic and finding nothing useful when the front door opens and a woman walks in. She looks calm and reserved and introduces herself as Marin, Deaton's sister. Her voice is vaguely familiar, and trying to remember where he's heard it before nags at him. He knows she's a guidance counselor, so he's probably met her before, but can't recall having actually done so. Tom isn't sure how to go about asking her if she knows about werewolves and magic and all of that, without possibly making her think that he's crazy. Fortunately for him, Chris has a lot more experience with that sort of thing. He offers Marin a disarming smile and says, we've been looking through Dr. Deaton's things and we've found some unusual items. We were hoping you might be able to tell us more about them, if they might have anything to do with his disappearance.
Of course, Marin says,
and stays silent while Chris shows her some of Deaton's books and the little jars and vials he keeps of what's obviously ingredients for spells. Tom gets distracted by the proceedings when he sees that one of the little vials has a familiar symbol on it. Do you recognize this? He asks Marin, trying to remember where he's seen it before. Marin shakes her head.
I'm sorry, I don't.
She's being so quiet and useless that Tom is starting to think that it must be an act. There's no way Deaton's sister would be so completely clueless about his life to not even know about the fact that he was a druid. He supposes it's possible that she's not saying anything because she doesn't want them to think she's crazy. But that seems unlikely. Deaton's sister should know who he is, who Chris Argent is. If she's not saying anything, there has to be a reason.
Sheriff,
she says, drawing his attention back to the situation at hand, and he jumps a little as he realizes where he's heard her voice before.
Please, whatever you can do to find my brother.
How did you know where Erica and Boyd were? Tom interrupts. Chris looks up from what he's doing, a frown creasing his face. Marin blinks, taken aback.
I'm sorry? I don't...
I just figured out why your voice was familiar. You called me when Erica and Boyd were missing to tell me they were being held in the vault. How did you know? And why did you tip me off anonymously instead of coming to me with more detail?
Maybe because I knew you'd want to know how I knew,
Marin says, her face going calm and expressionless. Good call, because I do.
And I'm afraid I can't tell you.
Tom narrows his eyes at her, thinking all this over. Alan was Talia's emissary, and I came here to ask him about Deucalion after Boyd and Erica went missing. Right after that conversation is when you called me, which means that Alan called you and told you to call me so I could help the kids. He focuses on her heartbeat. It's slow, steady, unconcerned. Or Alan called you and told you that I was close, that I was going to find them soon, so you acted to preempt me. Her face is still blank and unworried,
but her heartbeat ticks up at those words.
Sheriff, I was just doing what I thought was best.
Uh-huh. He was pissed, wasn't he?
My brother doesn't really get pissed.
Not Alan. Deucalion. He was pissed off because I plastered his face all over the news. Because people were snooping around. Mundanes who had no idea of how powerful and important he is, or at least perceives himself to be. He was primed to do something violent, something that couldn't be undone. Then Alan calls and tells you that I came to see him, that it's clear that I'm not going to just sit back and wait for Deucalion to make a move.
None of this is relevant to the fact that my brother is missing, Marin says.
Tom raises his eyebrows. You think so? From where I'm standing, it couldn't be more relevant. You clearly have inside information on Deucalion's movements. Alan somehow neglected to tell me that his own sister was involved with the Alpha Pact. Now he's missing, despite not exactly matching the Darak's victim profile for this group. The other two were doctors. Alan is a veterinarian.
He's a healer.
He's a druid whose alliances aren't clear, who has withheld crucial information from me on more than one occasion, Tom replies. None of the other victims managed to make a phone call before disappearing. So from where I'm standing, it looks like there's a strong possibility that Alan isn't missing at all, that he's set me off on a wild goose chase to keep me occupied and separated from my pack while Deucalion makes his move. Marin is starting to appear genuinely frustrated.
The Darak doesn't work for Deucalion, Sheriff. She's going to kill my brother if you don't find him.
But how do I know that? Am I supposed to take your word on it?
I helped you rescue those kids.
Sure, but I don't think you did it for them, and I know you didn't do it for me. Marin's mouth purses.
What do you want, Sheriff? How can I convince you that the danger to my brother is real?
Let's start by you telling me how you knew where those kids were. There's a moment of silence. Then Marin huffs out a breath.
I'm Deucalion's emissary. I have been for over a decade, but we aren't close. When he went off on his killing spree, I stayed here. He called me a few months ago to let me know that he was going to be coming back to Beacon Hills. We've met up a few times since he got here. When he kidnapped those two kids, it was supposed to take you months to find them, by which point the girl would be feral when exposed to the light of the full moon. And yes, he was enraged that you called in the mundane cavalry. That's not how it's done, she makes air quotes. I told him that you weren't like other werewolves, and he was furious that I hadn't foreseen what you would do. It was clear that his plan to keep the girl separated from Moonlight for months wasn't going to work, so yes, I nipped it in the bud before things could get worse.
Does he know that you called and told me?
No, he thinks you just found him using the police officers.
Okay, so you're still in his confidence. Great. Where is he staying?
Marin's mouth thins. I'm not going to tell you that, Sheriff.
Tom studies her for a few moments before deciding that he's not going to push on that particular issue. They'll have other ways to find Deucalion and his henchmen, and he doesn't trust that Marin won't either lie or warn Deucalion that he's been exposed. Okay, who's the Darak?
How would I know that? Marin asks, exasperated.
Well, you clearly have more of an idea than we do, Tom says, and Marin just looks at him blankly. You said she. She's going to kill my brother. You're assuming it's a woman. Why? Marin goes still.
I suppose I was just thinking of what kind of person would kill innocents to gain power.
And that made you think it was a woman? Tom shakes his head. I don't buy it. You might not know who it is for sure, but you've got an idea. So let me ask you a different question, Marin. Who was left alive after Deucalion's first killing spree?
Nobody,
Marin says. You're sure of that?
Positive.
Nobody survived. Not even, say, one of the other emissaries, who could have used her own power to save herself, who's lived biding her time until Deucalion came back to Beacon Hills, who could be sacrificing people for power so she can get her revenge.
Marin meets his gaze. None of the other emissaries survived, Sheriff.
Then why did you? Chris speaks up for the first time, glowering at Marin from the corner. Why did Deucalion leave you alive? You'd have to ask him.
I don't think I do, Chris says. I think killing an emissary is dangerous. It only works if they don't see you coming. I think Deucalion didn't want to risk taking you on.
You're entitled to think whatever you want, Marin says.
If you're going to continue to insist all the emissaries were killed, how about you tell us who they were, Tom says. That way I can double-check. There would only be two, right? You survive, and Aiden and Ethan didn't have their own pack. That means it's only Callie and Ennis's emissaries that we have to worry about.
Marin stares him down. If I give you those two names, you'll do your best to find my brother, to save his life? You'll give me your word?
Tom nods. You have my word.
Marin lets out a breath. Callie's was a woman named Julia Bakari. Ennis's was Raven Olson.
Okay.
Tom jots the two names down. He slides the piece of paper into his pocket and says to Chris, let's get back to work.